Hey, welcome to the Joe Scarborough Podcast. You all know one part of the story of this podcast. It started in 47. I came back from the war. One thing I did not tell you, a guy who saved my life when I was over at the war, during the war, Roger Bennett. I don't remember a lot. It was a long time ago, but Rog, those were crazy times. We came back from the war. I lived in Levittown. You did your thing. I don't know. But it's great to have you here. Great to have you here, Roger.
It's a joy. That's normally part of our story we don't talk about, Joe Scarborough, but it's an absolute delight to be with you.
Well, heroes don't talk about it, Roger. Heroes don't talk about it. You know
oh,
that.
You've done
the Band of Brothers podcast.
Yeah.
You did this Band of Brothers podcast. I just got to jump there. And I will say there were so many times, and I've seen it all the time. There's so many times that I had to wipe tears from the side of my kind of, so many times. It's hard, though, to not just completely break down at the very end when you see these men and you see Dick Winters saying what every hero I've ever heard talking about war, when you try to call them a hero, says. And Dick Winters said at the very end, the heroes were the guys that never came home.
Yeah, he also says, you know, the story of a grandchild saying to one of his men, were you a hero, grandfather? He says, I was no hero, but I served in the company of heroes. And so the Band of Brothers podcast has been one of the joys of my life, a true honor to be able to celebrate the 20th anniversary by creating that. As someone that loves America, as you know, Joe, I revere it. I watch Band of Brothers every year, as no doubt many of your listeners will be nodding along in this moment and say, I do too. It's 20 years old. I think it's a show that becomes more popular the older it gets. And you know, in COVID, in lockdown, in Manhattan, in those dark moments early on when there was fear and chaos and the unknown, and wanting to show my youngest kid, Oz, 10, the face of an America that I grew up believing in, one where there was everyday heroism, one where there was sacrifice, one where there was a sense of leadership when the world needed it, global leadership. I put on Band of Brothers. We watched it every night. We tweeted about watching it every night, and people started to watch along with us. And so to be able to go and speak to Tom Hanks, to go and speak to Damian Lewis, to go and speak to the cast, the producers of the show to celebrate the 20th anniversary, these men who met the men who truly served in Easy Company, it's been one of the most inspiring projects I've ever been involved in.
Because Mika was at Ground Zero during 9/11 and for a few weeks after, she never really got a chance to see Band of Brothers. But I tried to explain to her, and it sounded so trite, I tried to explain to her how Band of Brothers got so many of us through those weeks and months following 9/11. And it's something that I don't think she just could never connect with. And I understand why, because she's like, wait a second, you're talking about a TV show? And so I played it. I finally got, during COVID, I got her to stop and actually sit and watch it. And she's a Brzezinski. They're very tough. She wept so many times throughout it and completely understood when it ended just what Band of Brothers had meant to Americans in the fall of 2001.
Yeah, the show was released in the week. The opening episode ran the week before 9/11 and was then suspended when 9/11 occurred to release a show which tried to take the nature of war telling, which really war movies were part of the war effort. While the war was going on, the president commanded Hollywood to make motivational, the John Wayneification of war movies, and what Hanks and Spielberg tried to do, first with Saving Private Ryan, and then realizing, as great as that movie was, by presenting the unvarnished, as close as you can on film, the unvarnished horror of the war experience, they realized, this is what I love about those two guys, is many creators would have said, we've done that now, let's move on to the next thing. We have a creative bandwidth in our career that's not infinite, let's move on. They've kept going back to the same themes, the same period. They're about to do it again with a series on Apple around the Air Force, but they went back to the Pacific and they did it again. But Band of Brothers, what that did was rewrite the war experience on film in, and on television, presenting it not as a heroic thing, not as a thing, as one of the producers we interviewed said, you know, before Band of Brothers, whenever anybody died in a war movie, they died painlessly, heroically. They either just cried out briefly, and the general would write home and say how brave they were. Band of Brothers showed that war is not like that, death is not like that, and heroism is not like that. And I think it's more than a television show. It's an incredibly important social document. And the last thing I'll say about this is that the thing that struck me and my team as we produced this podcast series is the statistic that came out that last summer there were 300,000 men still alive who had fought in the Second World War. This summer, there's just 100,000, and the youngest of them are late 90s. And I think it behooves all of us in this moment to think about this changing period where the first-hand experiences would have informed so many of our lives. I'm sure your family, Joe, you know, there was in your family telling. Right behind me is my grandfather, Sam,
right,
who was a desert rat who fought in Africa. We knew, we were shaped by, but the future of the world will not be shaped by individuals who are able to hear these stories firsthand. And I think almost Band of Brothers and documents like it become even more critical.
Yeah, my grandfather fought in World War One. My uncle fought in World War Two. He went over when he was 17. Yeah, we grew up hearing the stories, and there was that connection. Also, with Band of Brothers and with Normandy, I went over, I guess it was in 2004 for the 60th. Was it the 60th anniversary? And it was remarkable how many vets were there, who had been there, and you would talk to him, and I would look down the cliffs. I'd say, how did you do it? He said, well, we really weren't thinking. I was 18 years old. You know, they told us to climb up the hill and kill Germans. We just climbed up the hill and killed. And I said to myself, I thought to myself then, I said, well, that's why you send 18-year-olds and not 28-year-olds, because they just were following orders. And it was the 21, 22, 23-year-olds that were keeping them alive as they were going up the hill. It's remarkable in the society we live in now that it was the 22, 23-year-olds that were the grizzled veterans.
Dick Winter's a leader because, you know, he'd been through college. He was 22, 23. That was a veteran. He'd seen life. These were kids of the Depression that had seen nothing. They had seen nothing. And suddenly they're in Europe. Some of the guys I spoke to, I spoke to Damian Lewis, who are about to release his episode where he joked with Dick Winters, who he knew well from making the show. And they joked that these men, I watched the show and I spent the whole time, I said this to Tom Hanks, you know, Tom Hanks said that he hoped the message was, you ask yourself, what could you do? And I said, Tom, to be honest, I look at the show the whole time, I'm like, couldn't do that, wouldn't do that.
Right.
How do they do that? How do they jump out of a plane into just a sky pockmark with bullets, with death? And so Damian Lewis said, these kids, he said, they were afraid of nothing. The thing that filled many of them with fear was actually flying on a plane for the first time after war, because the first time they'd flown a plane, they were actually jumping out of it.
Right.
And he said, so many of them said, the thing that made them crap their pants was when they'd be with their family flying on vacation. They're like, holy crap, they're going to land this thing? We didn't know you landed. We thought you just jumped out of it. And so, he said that was like the only time many of the men showed real fear was actually landing on a plane with their kids on vacation. It's another world. It's another mindset. And that tenacity. I mean, I'm fascinated by tenacity, Joe. I think it's the quality that is probably the theme of much of my work, even though my work is fairly curious, idiosyncratic, and diverse. But that is a show that's just soaked in tenacity.
You know, one of the most moving moments of my life came in 2004 when I went over for the, I guess it's the 60th anniversary of D-Day. It was in 2004 during the Iraq War. A lot of the French people not really happy with Americans. It's all we heard about. People were saying, I did a show called Scarborough Country. I may have said one or two unkind things about the French. Scarborough Country. No passport required, only common sense allowed. My other car is an SUV and it's double parked in Scarborough Country. It was that type of show. But anyway, so we go over to France, and I'm thinking it's going to be a rough ride because, you know, all we're hearing is how much the French hate the Americans. And
we're not in Scarborough Country anymore.
Exactly. And the Germans, hate Americans. First of all, in Paris, I was shocked as we got in Paris and stayed there a day or so before we went out to Normandy. I was shocked how many French people came up to say, "We love you. We don't love your president. We don't love this war. But we remember. We thank you." That, I'm really surprised because I'd been to Paris a few times before on like high school trip, college trips, and I don't remember the French being that kind. But we got out to Normandy, and the American flags, for anybody that's never been out to Normandy around June the 6th, American flags were everywhere. Just everywhere. The gratitude, people coming up, thanking you. And there was a moment where we walked down the road, down past the cemetery, and there was a veteran. I was walking with a vet. He's probably 75, 76 at the time. And a young French couple who were probably in their late 20s came up. They had a six, seven-year-old girl, and she came up holding flowers and handed it to this 78-year-old man. And she said, "I want to thank you. My mommy and daddy say I'm here and I'm free because of you." It's hard to say without me tearing up right now. The vet broke down crying. All of us around broke down crying. But that's the sort of remarkable spirit that always surrounds those events.
I have so many reactions to it. And it's true, the French, there's a lot they do love. They love Jerry Lee Lewis. They love David Hasselhoff. They have curious taste filter when it when it comes to things American. But you know, one of the drivers for me in my work for the past couple of years, and particularly with the book I wrote, was driven by, you know, I grew up with that love. I grew up with a sense of America. All of that which you've described, and more, just as a place of hope, of joy, of possibility. Whereas, you know, post-war Britain, post-industrial Britain, Britain in the 1980s, which was still grappling with the aftershocks of the Second World War and the ensuing collapse of the British economy, particularly up north, where just the coal, the steel, the cotton, everything was just shattered and never recovered post-war. You know, we looked at America, and I know it's been a theme on your show with a number of guests recently. We grew up with America was just a such a nourishing idea, and it was an idea. And I know the idea and the reality are two very different things that we may or may not talk about. But one of the drivers for me has been a Pew Foundation study in 2017. Where they uncovered for the first time that Western Europe had a negative impression of America when they asked people, "Do you think positively or negatively of America?" 2017, I think it was only something like 47% of Western Europeans thought positively about America. And I have to be candid, when I read that, having lived with America saving me at times in my own life, the idea of America, I found that devastating, Joe. You know, your French experience, it shows the depth of the love, the depth of the gratitude, the depth of the thanks. And that thing is, that is not a given. And that the implosion of that in the recent period, I found personally devastating.
Yeah, you know, it's so interesting. And I love talking to you. I've always loved talking to you about America because I love talking to immigrants about America, because I think Americans are often like rich, spoiled kids. They've had it their entire life. They've had freedom their entire life, whether they're wealthy or whether they're middle class or whether they're working class. They've had the freedoms their entire life. They've had the opportunity to succeed, and I still believe do at least aspire to do great things. And I think at times we take it for granted here. Most of the time we take it for granted. But I talk to an immigrant, whether they're from West Africa or whether they're from Liverpool, and they tell me the same thing. This America this is the greatest country in the world. I can be something here that I could never be at home. And you say you feel that. You told me this a long time ago. You feel that every time your plane lands at JFK.
Every time a plane lands at JFK, I am so, doesn't matter where I'm coming from. I feel just an incredible sense of relief and an incredible sense of gratitude. It's something I never take for granted. When I wake up, you know, I'm a kid that grew up in Liverpool in the 1980s. If you've seen Billy Elliot, you kind of get the picture of just how, I mean, Liverpool was a port city that once was one of the mighty ports globally. And then with the post-industrial collapse, when every, you know, the Sheffield, their steel mills were silenced, when the Newcastle coal pits were closed over, Leicester, Leather, every city had an industrial base and every city was devastated. Liverpool was a port that no longer had any meaning and unemployment soared. There was a heroin epidemic. We were demonized. I mean, Thatcher particularly scapegoated Liverpool. Liverpool, when I grew up, there was a debate in the city council about whether Liverpool should cede and become a socialist republic of its own, like the Vatican City, which I thought was fantastic. Yeah, 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 sure. Just have my own passport, a citizen of Liverpool. By the way, I loved it, but it was pretty devastating and possibility and what kind of a future. And I couldn't imagine one. And so I painted the Manhattan skyline on my bedroom wall when I was 12, 13. I'd go to sleep every night. Lady Liberty, a very crude representation of her, the Statue of Liberty, was painted on that wall too. And I now live here in that city that I dreamt of as a kid. And I never take it for granted. I listened to Fiona Hill on your show articulate that so beautifully and so poignantly. And I feel it deeply. You know, I wrote a book about it, Reborn in the USA, trying to articulate the sense of love, the sense of gratitude, the power that the American idea had over, really, it's a central idea around which I've organized my life, Joe. And I always say, you know, 2018, July 1st, I became American. And if you stand in a courtroom and raise your hand, it was 240 people from 61 countries. And afterwards, you all share stories of how you came to America. And my stories, you know, of surviving a couple of late night beatings in chip shops after the pubs closed in Liverpool were pathetic compared to stories of people who'd escaped famine, civil war, crossed deserts to be here. But the one thing we all shared was a sense of the power of the idea of America in our lives, giving us hope, the strength, the ability to persevere when we needed it. And any of your listeners, you know, a lot of human beings want to connect to that sense of that joy, that sense of wonder, the American idea. And anyone can go to a citizenship swearing in. And I'd encourage anyone who wants it, craves it, needs it, go to one of those. It's really life-changing. Whether it's you being sworn in or not, it's beautiful.
It's life-changing. It is so beautiful. It's so emotional. And I've loved hearing you talk about it before. Roger, you know, I'm a skeptic when I hear, you talked about that Pew poll, only 47% of Europeans, Western Europeans like America or look up to America. I've been hearing the decline narrative about the United States since I was a kid. You know, I was in the 70s, I was you know, maybe 75, I was 12 years old, and I remember my seventh grade teacher saying the United States was in decline, and we were like the old Roman Empire. This was after Vietnam and Watergate, and it would be a matter of years before we were finished off. I would hear the same thing, you know, in high school. I'd hear the same thing in college. I'd read books. They'd say, you know, Japan, the Japan that could say no, they weren't going to give us semiconductor chips and our nuclear weapons were going to fall hopelessly into the sea and we'd be Japan's granary. Then I started hearing it about China and on and on and on. And we still remained. Economically, our GDP is extraordinary. You look at our military power, it's extraordinary. You go down all the lists of power, and I can quantify those numbers and explain that to my viewers and my listeners. What I can't do is explain the part of Reborn in the USA that I thought was so important. And that is the soft power, the cultural power that the United States of America still has. You always read these stories about how much people hate America, even in Iraq. I remember after Abu Ghraib, you know, we were just horrified by reading this. And the whole thing was these people, they hate America, they hate America, they hate America. And then the last paragraph, the question was, what can be done to make this right for you? Would you like to guess what the answer was? Let us move to America. Let us move to America. We want to live in America. That is the dream. And people all across the world that I still talk to still believe that the streets may not be paved with gold, but it's the next best thing. And you talk about the soft power. You talk about, I love even saying this, Heart to Heart, Fantasy Island,
all
these TV shows that you watched that actually... Miami Vice, you'd look at...
Oh, my God.
You would say...
Yeah, don't get me started.
I want to be there. Explain that the power of American soft power and how it was a magnet to young Roger Bennett.
Do I have to explain? Anyone who watched Heart to Heart will be nodding, going, yeah, of course, Jonathan Hart. I mean,
heart
just Stephanie.
Heart.
I mean, just like one woman who knows how to take care of herself. I mean, just amazing, amazing. Television, I think, is self-evident and doesn't need me to unpack it. But I will say, Miami Vice, in particular, it wasn't really about fighting narcos in Florida. It was really a show that was put together. That's like say, Animal Farm is about horses and pigs.
Right.
Under the surface, it's about knowing globally there's 13, 14-year-olds who don't know what to do with themselves, boys around America who need guidance, and Don Johnson, you know, everyone else is going to the shootout that may end their lives in Kevlar and helmets, but not for him. Why would he put Kevlar on when he can just go in a pair of linen pants with pleats, espadrilles, no socks, a dangerous game, and a T-shirt under his jacket with sleeves rolled up? And that T-shirt,
exactly.
I remember I'd be like, Mum, what's that color? And she'd be like, I don't know. I've never seen it before. It turns out it was teal. It hadn't been invented in England yet. And we were just like, we were like mesmerized.
Oh,
and
my God.
Don Johnson was saying, be singular, be different to everybody else. Don't be afraid if you're feeling that, but just stick. If you have a singular style, stick to it. And I wanted that. I remember I found out that he lived on a houseboat, his character, with a pet alligator named Elvis. And when in school, it was time to do a careers session where they planned out your future. And they asked me what I wanted to be when I grew up. I wrote, I want to live in a houseboat with a pet alligator named Elvis. But the still a life goal. But the reality is, Joe, you know, I grew up with the power of an idea, a kid's idea, a romantic idea. But like any kid's love, and I did love America. I loved it absolutely. William Refrigerator Perry, the Chicago Bears, the movies of John Hughes, Molly Ringwald, Run DMC, Public Enemy, Tracy Chapman. These were John Mellencamp's Scarecrow album. These were massive, massive forces in my life that shaped the way I felt and thought and believed and dreamt and enacted on those dreams. But I also wrote the book, Joe, about my love of America, trying to work out the breadcrumbs through the enchanted forest that had led me here to be American, to have an American wife, to have four American kids. And I wrote it in the chaos of COVID. It was a human darkness. And then that darkness just plummeted into the summer of the agony of the Black Lives Matter movement and just a deep, deep pain and trauma watching that into the toxicity of the 2020 election. So there's the love, there's the idea, there's the kid's idea, and then there's the adult love, which I have now, and I've learned in life that adult love is not a given. Like any love relationship, something you have to work at, it's something you have to appreciate the object of the love with strengths and with weaknesses and commit to appreciating the strengths and working on the latter, the weaknesses. But the reality is everything is always in flux. You said, you know, it's always been in flux. It's always, doom's always been predicted. But I will say it was a wild and remarkable time to write a love letter to America. The way it's been received has been very humbling, but I couldn't have written it at a time of greater challenge, in my experience, for our nation.
Well, and I thought it was interesting. I mean, it zoomed up to number one. There are a lot of people that wanted to hear about why you loved America, why you believed in America. And I do think, I think most Americans are like me, and I'm sure like you. We love this country. We think it is an extraordinary force for good in the world. It also has some great challenges, and we just have to be dialectical in our thinking about it. Two things can be possible at once. Our founding fathers owned slaves, and at the same time, they wrote the most extraordinary founding documents in the history of the world that have actually led to freedom of more human beings than any other political documents ever written before or since. And it's the same thing with the mistakes that we make as a country daily. I guess the thing that exasperates me the most is I've spent most of my adult life telling people it was going to be okay, that we were going to get through whoever was president, whether it was George W. Bush or Barack Obama or Donald Trump or now Joe Biden. It just, the catastrophizing gets so exhausting. And at some point, I just feel like shaking some of my friends and relatives and saying, damn it, we're Americans. Have more faith in your country. I always remember back in when I was at University of Alabama, I loved Ronald Reagan. And I like the people in the 49 states that voted for Ronald Reagan. I thought he was just the greatest president ever. And I remember talking to the head of the history department where you're having lunch, and I asked him about halfway through, like, what do you think of Ronald Reagan? And he was quiet for a moment. He said, well, I believe that the United States of America is strong enough to even survive two terms of Ronald Reagan. And I was shocked that he would say that about Reagan. And then the more I thought about it, I thought, that's just beautiful. That this guy that I have great respect for loathes the politician that, you know, I'm inspired by.
And this is at the University of Alabama.
University of Alabama. And I always adopted that idea, that I always remembered him saying that to me and understanding, out of many one, this guy that I loved and respected, I thought would love Reagan, I actually saw him as a threat to the United States of America. And yet, his response to it was, I think we as a nation are even strong enough to survive 8 years of Ronald Reagan.
More civil times, Joe Scott, because you may have felt that back then, but now if you heard that, your response would be, delete your account.
Yeah, exactly.
It is a wild and remarkable world, and you'll have smarter guests than me to analyze that. But I'll say that, you know, I said this on your show when I came on to talk about the book. When you write an epigraph for a book, it's a weird thing because you're using somebody else's words to introduce the themes of your own. And normally they're so much better than anything that you can write. And that's right. Certainly the case. In my example, I used two people that I really admire. The first is Jason Isbell, the singer. One of his lyrics, I used to want to be a real man. I don't know what that even means, which I really, really love. But in terms of this conversation, the lines of Langston Hughes, the great poet who wrote Let America Be America Again.
Oh, I love
The land that never has been yet and yet must be. And in that, that kind of discordant, the emotional and the rational, but like the commitment to the idea and the commitment to closing the gap between the idea. That's what I hope when you read my book, that there's a commitment to closing we realize what is an idea, what is real, what is far from real, the power of both, the power of perception, but we commit ultimately to trying to close the gap between the two. That's I think that's one of the most important things for our moment and our time.
Yeah, one of the most remarkable poems about America, the land that never was, but the land that must be. I want to ask you about, you're talking about America and America being sort of the cultural promised land for you. I've got to ask you this question. As a guy that I didn't have the Statue of Liberty painted on my wall or any other icons, in fact, I didn't put posters on my wall unless they were John, Paul, George, or Ringo. I was, I don't know why, but I became such an avid Beatles fan. I scare Mika whenever people come up and will throw a trivia question at me. I just, you know, don't ask me who replaced Ringo on tour when he had tonsillitis. It was Jimmy Nichols in 65, I think it was. But the Beatles, the rest of the world sees the Beatles, especially Americans. Pete Townsend has said this before. It's just this is extraordinary, peerless force. And yet, that all happened in your neighborhood. That all happened in your backyard. Your uncle, we've talked about this before offline. Your uncle knew Brian Epstein. Brian wanted to know your uncle, or was it your father?
My dad.
Your dad.
Yeah, George Ivor. Well, no, on his, yes, you're a beautiful man. So the Epstein family, Brian's brother, late brother, Clive.
By the way, for people who don't know, Brian Epstein was the Beatles manager. He sort of discovered the Beatles. He was responsible in large part for managing their rise, getting them to America on the Sullivan Show, et cetera, et cetera. He passed away in 67, tragically. Go ahead.
Yeah, and he was, my dad grew up with them, best friends.
Wow.
Clive was my godfather. I grew up with the Epstein kids as my best friends. They still are, still deeply connected to the entire family. So, I mean, there's two things. The personal thing is, you know, I always saw the Beatles through that lens of a darkness that fell on that family in the wake of all the happenings. And I saw that side of fame and the personal wound that it can create. In Liverpool, you know, by the way, everything came to Liverpool first from America. Like Liverpool has always felt, and I write about this in my book, deeply connected. We felt like we were a state. Like we felt more connected to America than to England. England was full of tossers and just Southerners and awful people.
Well, and you know, the Beatles became the Beatles because they would get the records from America on the port.
Yes.
The country records, the R&B stuff.
Liverpool first. It hit Liverpool. It rolled off those boats into Liverpool. Rock and roll hit us first. So the Beatles came out of Liverpool. And by the way, when I said Southerners, I meant Southern English people.
Yeah, exactly.
The worst. By the way, I don't like to generalize, but the worst. Yeah. Not you, Catty K. And so we felt so bloody close to America in every regard. But your bigger question is something I've learned from writing this book. This book that I wrote is about a young gentleman, me, who survived by dreaming of another place, another, almost an alter ego, who, you know, the young Rog was having a miserable time in Liverpool. American Rog, in my imagination, was doing all the things I couldn't. You know, he wore Reebok pumps.
Right.
He went to a high school in the Chicago suburbs. You know, everyone laughed at his jokes. I had this complete alter ego. What I've learned from doing this book, Joe, is what you experience by romanticizing and falling in love with the Beatles and experiencing emotions through that love. I've had thousands of Americans reach out to me and be like, holy crap, you dreamt of growing up in Chicago in the suburbs there. I grew up I loved The Cure. I wanted to grow up outside of London.
Right.
I love The Smiths. I wanted to grow up outside of Manchester. And I first response, I laughed and I was like, oh my God, did you ever dodge a bullet? But it happened so many times. And what I've realized is it's an adolescent rite of passage to wish you'd lived somewhere else, that there was another you, a funnier you, a more popular you, a more joyous, a more talented, a chance to start over again you. And the only thing that's different is I actually acted upon that. I made that real.
Wow.
I didn't just talk about it or have it as a whimsy. You know, I carried it through. I moved here at my earliest possibility, moved to Chicago.
Did your parents think you were crazy?
Oh, yeah. Oh my God. It was an insane thing. I mean, Manchester felt far away from where I grew up. Look, Manchester was like 35 minutes away, but it was like walking into a Star Wars cantina. I didn't understand. You didn't understand Manchester. They were mad. It was crazy. These people, it was another world. London felt like you disappeared through a hole in time if you moved there. So to lift up and move to America, it was, I mean, I've got to say, Christopher Columbus probably had an easier, it was probably made more sense to his family that he was going to America than than mine. They just thought it was absolutely bonkers. I think there's still some part of them that finds it bonkers. But my great-grandfather, Joe, this is the family myth. My great-grandfather, Harris, I have a portrait of him right here. He was that's him in the Russian army, where he was press gang for 20 years.
Yeah.
He was a kosher butcher, and he fled Ukraine in the early 1900s. And the myth of my family is that he was headed to Chicago, the hog capital of the world. Why wouldn't you move there if you want to make a fortune?
Right.
And, you know, the idiots on the boat when it docked in Liverpool to refuel on the way to America, saw the one tall building on the Liverpool skyline, thought they were in New York, and were like, we're here, let's get off. And so we, the myth that when things were dark with my family in Liverpool, as they often were, my grandfather, who I was very close with, would take this Statue of Liberty, this plastic tchotchke, off his mantelpiece, this very tchotchke, and he'd look at it with me, because I was very close with him. I played chess with him every afternoon as a kid. Mm-hmm. And he'd say, see this, son, we should have lived there. We should have lived there. And that's the power of the eye. So to some degree, they thought it was absurd, but to another degree, I was just completing my family's journey, albeit three generations later.
You know, a lot of investment apps make it easy to start trading, but just because it's easy doesn't necessarily mean you know what you're doing. But that's what makes Wealthfront different. They make it easy to invest, and they make it easy to get smarter about investing. Yes, yeah, stocks, memes, rocket ships, day trading, that can be a lot of fun. But if you want to grow your long-term wealth and make it to the moon, you should open up a Wealthfront investment account today. After answering just a couple of questions, Wealthfront will build you a diversified portfolio of low-cost index funds, and they'll do it in minutes. You can build your own portfolio with clean energy funds, crypto trusts, tech, and hundreds of other investments. Wealthfront even offers a socially responsible portfolio, a mix of funds that are built around human rights, climate change, sustainability, and diversity. Best of all, Wealthfront is totally automated. They do all the trading, all the rebalancing, and they even help you lower your tax bill while you invest. Wealthfront is trusted with over $27 billion in assets, helping nearly 500,000 people build their wealth. To start building your wealth and get your first $5,000 managed for free for life, go to wealthfront.com/gojoe. That's wealthfront.com/gojoe to start building your wealth. That's wealthfront.com/gojoe and get started today. Yeah, let me ask you, what do you love the most about America? What do you find to be America's greatest challenge?
I love, at this point, I love my wife and I love my children. I love that I wake up every morning and I have four kids with American accents, which is, you know, I still have no American accent. I can't even do one. I have no,
apparently. You can't even pretend.
I can't even say $1 million or hooray for Hollywood. I think it's pathetic. So I'm just so grateful that I've been able to lift myself up and place myself here. And I do, waking up in New York and just and hearing the city around me. And it is just a journey, a joy that I never take for granted. And anyone who moves here will tell you, it's the tiny, like I still, to this day, walk into supermarkets and I'm like, oh my God, there's 27 kinds of mushrooms here. Like in England, we just had canned mushrooms.
Right.
And it was like, there's so much joy. I feel going to an American gas station, I'm still aware, oh my God, the American gas stations. I constantly feel like I'm in Willy Wonka's chocolate factory living here. And anyone who takes it for granted will not understand what I'm talking about. But life feels for me so effervescent, so full of gratitude, and I'm truly humbled by it. And the challenge is, you have a show that grapples with them, that you allow me on for a couple of minutes every Monday, ridiculously and wondrously. And I owe you a great debt that we may or may not talk about in this show. for doing it. I mean, your show is full of those challenges, and they are, I think, you know, going back to your earlier, I think they're very real. I think they're very frightening. I think there's a whole new set of, there's a reordering of the way we communicate, the way we organize, the way we form community, that have shifted the very tectonic plates underneath, not just our nation, but, you know, globally, watching Britain grapple with Brexit, which has been shaped by so many of the same forces. So the fodder of your show on a morning by morning basis is what fills me with fear.
Do you remember when you first started coming on the show? I was trying.
Yeah, I do. And I, by the way, if this is the only thing I can I do say that is deeply meaningful, rather than me blabber on the show, I do want to say I'm so bloody grateful to you, to Mika, to the producers of the show, who have become just, I mean, I've been on for so bloody long now. It's remarkable, but it's where I learned to do television and live television. And I owe a real debt of gratitude, because so much of what I've been able to do has resulted from our very serendipitous relationship. 2010 World Cup.
Ah, that's right.
I'd written a terrible book, an ESPN book, a history of the World Cup. And you
I
had
love it.
Me on. It was one of those moments fans of your show will know, sometimes you are both not there, and so the poor guests come into a completely empty studio. And it's like really, really bloody weird. And actually, you know, it wasn't empty. Willie was there. Yeah. Very young Willie Geist. I think he just started. He was about seven.
Yeah.
In a beautiful suit. Beautiful suit. Beautiful head of hair.
Beautiful.
So Willie was there, had no, made it very clear, no interest in football. I mean, very, very clear, no interest in football. And you were remote, and you were, you know, I got on, I was going to talk about my book, and you were just gushing. You were just like, you talked about Zidane, you talked about how you'd fallen in love. I was so shocked how you'd fallen in love with football. You wanted me to pump the World Cup. Mika did a Mika thing. Oh, well, I don't know what they're talking about. But you were like so micro into it. You're like throwing out these facts. It was amazing and hilarious. And I'd never done live TV before, and it was wonderful and weird, and we were funny together, and it was quite hilarious. And at the end of it, you know, I was leaving, and Alex Corson and Chris Licht,
right.
God love, great Chris Licht, who's just an amazing, you have good people.
I mean, do.
Other producers, John Tower, an early producer for you, who is so young
Tower
and had just started.
Power.
Just great human beings that I adore working with at every opportunity. They run up to me and were like, Joe's asked, can you come on every day during the World Cup? And I was like, what?
Yeah.
And I went home. I said, this guy's just asked me to go on his show every morning, to my 9 months pregnant wife, who was about to have our third kid. And she's like, great, go and do it. And so every day during the World Cup, you had me on. And for me, it was a crash course in television. But the way you shoot it, with the camera moving around,
right,
just everyone arguing, just people shouting out crazy crap, I found it like my family dinner table.
Right.
It was hilarious. It was like instead of the guests that you had on, it was like, it was as if I was chatting to my grandmothers who were arguing and didn't get on. My parents were there. My brother was just upending the table. And I loved it. And I found it very energizing and wonderful. And we went to a football game. You got really into it. Even Mika got into it briefly, fleetingly. God love you, Mika. And we went to watch. Many of your listeners, even if they don't know anything about football, remember this. The US had a must-win game. And we went to watch it in a pub downtown.
Right.
Together, you brought your whole staff downtown. And Landon Donovan, England, America, were out of the World Cup. We're out. It was terrible, terrible. And then in the last second, Landon Donovan, still, anyone who knows about football will get great memories of just a full flowing length of the field. Goal, go, go, USA.
Right.
And I still can't remember whether it was you, Joe, or Mika just stood up, screamed at the moon, and flipped the table over.
Table.
It was an amazing moment.
Mika jumped up in the booth. And yeah, middle of the day. And kicked over the table, and we kept cheering for the goal. It was a remarkable goal. Kept cheering for the goal.
It was. Mika pretends not to know about football, but she make a very good hooligan.
Yeah, very good hooligan. She, by the way, a huge Rebecca Lowe fan. She thinks Rebecca Lowe is an extraordinary broadcaster.
She is.
Yeah, she is.
She is an extraordinary
broadcaster. So it's funny, Joey Scarborough, who you know very well. We've watched quite a few football matches together, you, me, and Joey, down.
Yep.
down in the East Village and other places, got me interested in 2006. And it was, I filled out a little pool, a little sheet, and by the end of France and Brazil, watching this guy named Zidane completely make mincemeat of Brazilians who were flying around going 1,000 miles an hour. He'd just stare at them as the ball moved under his feet. I just fell in love with it. It was a beautiful, beautiful game. He set up Henri with this extraordinary pass, back post, and by the time I saw it for the fourth time in slow motion, I was hopelessly hooked.
And that's what comes through. You know, I've always been quite struck by, just to be completely candid, we can say this out, the Premier League football at the time, I mean, now NBC has the property, you're ahead of the time, Joe,
right,
had no place whatsoever on your show. No. We both knew that. I always thought, you know, it was good for you because it played against your image, you know, of this Floridian politician. You were broadening yourself, like this was a very global, very intellectual.
Right.
So like I had a sense of, but I had to work out quickly how to talk about this sport on your show in a way that really didn't seem utterly ridiculous to most of your viewers. Arguably, I've still never got there, but it taught me, I always tried to represent it in a way that would at least engage some of your viewership. So I learned a lot by doing that, and I'm incredibly bloody grateful to it. But I remember one of the first times I was on, you were like, and now it's the Premier League. Which even every time you say it, I'm always like, oh my God, I can't believe we're doing it.
TV sets across America going off.
Yes.
And by the way, trust me, every producer, every front office person, we're all freaking out going,
oh, yes.
What are you doing? And I said,
what are you doing?
I said, I have a very simple belief. If I'm interested in it, then my viewers are interested in it. And that's proven to be the case. And,
you are so mad.
And then,
when
when you came on, they fell in love with you and it immediately got sticky and people started looking forward to it. And far from the ratings going down, when you'd come on, boop, they'd go up.
You are so mad. You are so bonkers. It was crazy. And I knew it was crazy. And your producers were completely clear how crazy it was.
Yeah.
But you were so into it and I loved it. So I tried to like broaden it and bring it. Anyway, so one of the first times you're on, you're like, now it's the Premier League moment and Mika's doing that. Oh my God, I can't. And I'm just like, okay, we're going in. And Donny Deutsch goes very quickly. I got like four. I was like, Liverpool versus Manchester. He's like, Donny Deutsch is like, hey, why are we doing this? Why are we doing this? There's like baseball and there's like, you know, basketball. There's American ball sports. And let's talk about them. And I was like, I don't know where this came from, but I was, again, it was live TV at this table. It was like being at my grandparents' table. I'm like, F this. I was like, Donny, do you have grandchildren? And he looked at me and he goes, yes. Why? I was like, because this is a young man's sport. I understand why you grew up in Brooklyn playing stickball in the olden days and you don't like this, but this is not for you. Just take a deep breath, Donny. Let me do the thing for the audience. And then I shut the hell up. So I was like, wicked. And we did it and it was good. And then when I got off, I was like, I can't believe what I just said.
Yeah.
That's crazy. And then like 2 weeks later, I was on the table again and you're like, let's do it. And I'm like, okay, Liverpool playing Chelsea. And Tom Brokaw goes, whoa, 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 whoa. And I was like, and he goes, why are we talking about this? The great American sport is baseball and it's in playoffs and we should be. And in my head, I was like, do I do the Donny Deutsch old man thing? I was like, and in my head, I was like, you can't do that. It's Tom Brokaw. You can't do that. It's like insulting the Queen. You just got to take this. And it was the worst 5 minutes of my career, still to this day. Brokaw lectured me, didn't shut up. No one put him back in his face. And for 5 minutes, he used up all my time. Essentially, when I look at this, and I do look at it on occasion, you should get your editors to pull it up. I essentially shrivel. I think I end up under the desk. And in that, while under the desk, I said to myself, I am never going to be asked back on this show. My career is over. Brokaw's killed me. And as I'm walking out, Alex Corson's like, next week. And I was like, you want me back? That was awful. That was just like humanly awful. And Alex's like, yeah, great, great. And I said,
we'll have you back next week. Brokaw won't be there though.
Yeah. I was like, I'd never want to go on with Tom Brokaw ever again. And for 2 years, I'd come on every Monday. And if Brokaw was on set, your floor producer would quietly have a word and Brokaw would F off and go and, you know, and then I'd like go on, but only when Brokaw was
our priorities straight.
And then after two years later, I was about to go on and Brooker was still sitting there. And I was like, to your floor producer, I was like, Brooker, get Brooker off. And she's like, nope, they want Brooker on. I was like, I'm not doing it with Brooker. And they're like, 10, 9, 8. Yeah. And so we're on. And I'm like, okay. And you're like, Premier League, let's do it. And I'm like, Manchester City again. Yeah. And Brooker goes, whoa.
Same thing.
And I was like, what? What, Brooker? What do you want to say? And he goes, 2 years ago, I mocked and derided you for doing soccer. He goes, now I want you to know my son-in-laws and I go over to England every Christmas and we take in 4 or 5 games together in that period, just us boys together. And then he went silent and he goes, and I fly coach. That was his kick up, which I loved. And I was like, and I said in that moment, I was like, Joe, holy crap. If we've got Brooker.
Yeah.
We've got America.
The great conversion. Well, now that's hilarious. Well, we've loved having you on, and it's been a great honor for us. Before we go, though, we have an opportunity to talk about one of my favorite subjects when you're talking about football, and that is when bad things happen to Ronaldo, and that is happening. I mean, of course, just on the pitch, but, you know, it's the damnedest thing for people that follow football. There was actually, Man U actually had a team at the beginning of the season that I actually feared for the first time in about 5, 6, 7 years. They actually seemed to have a squad that might be able to come together and take a run at it. And then they brought Ronaldo on board. It just doesn't work, does it?
So I say this succinctly. You know, football teams are collectives. And you need it's not like the NBA where just a couple of good players together can steamroll the opposition. You need balance. You need harmony. You need as close to egoless or by yourself. Self-interest needs to align. And the reality is Manchester United, owned by the Glazer family in Tampa Bay, have a unbelievable all-star team. But like any all-star team, without an idea of how it is going to unfurl itself, how an idea those individuals are going to mesh into something absolutely beautiful, a harmony, you know, a choir. It's like the A-team when they you can either take the bits that are lying around that barn and turn them into an improvised armored personnel carrier, or they can just be loose bits that are discarded all over the farm. And we are taping this after Liverpool's true, unbelievable collective. Mr. T could not put together a better collective. Given a bare bottom beatdown. And so Ronaldo, who is still one of the greatest players in the world, he looks like a warning that no human being can outrun time unless they're named Tom Brady. And there's a life lesson in all of that, Joe Scarborough.
He seems so selfish. Joey is a huge Ronaldo fan, or at least he's a fan of his skill, says he's a great, great talent. I've always thought he was so selfish. It was always hard to get past the selfishness of him on the field.
But the world's divided into two types of people. There's like those who adore Ronaldo and there's those who adore Lionel Messi. Lionel Messi, 5'7", looks like he's escaped from supercuts.
Yeah.
Ronaldo, you know, beautiful. Like he looks like he Michelangelo sculpted him. I think ultimately, if you believe in plucking your eyebrows, Ronaldo is like a bottle of Draco Noir in human form. But if you pluck your eyebrows aggressively, then you're normally nine times out of 10 team Ronaldo. Yeah. If you don't, you're normally team Lionel Messi. They're two very different approaches to life. And I think we're just blessed to have been alive to see both of them routinely just play ethereal sports.
I'm in the third group, and that's the Van Dijk group. I learned an awful lot last year when Van Dijk was out. And what I learned was that often a football team, it's not what's happening up front. It's not the great Salah. It's not Mane. It's not Bobby Firmino, who I love. All of them I love. It's that guy in the back, in the center, saying, okay, I'll tell you what. I got it back here. Why don't you guys push forward a little bit? And when he's gone, everything collapses. Everybody's on their back heel. And it's a nightmare. That guy, I've never seen any single player mean as much to a team as Virgil van Dijk means to Liverpool.
You can't have a great QB without a great O-line, Joe, is the reality. And he's an O-line all on his own.
Yeah.
Your joy for football fills me with joy. Your ridiculousness that having me on has given me so many ideas, so many possibilities, so much opportunity. I'm incredibly bloody grateful to you. I'm incredibly bloody grateful to Mika, who every week still I come on. And still, it makes it completely clear she has no idea why I keep coming on, but I'm incredibly grateful to all of you for doing
still,
it.
She still rolls her eyes, still pretends that she's bored by it all. But when Pretty Vacant comes on, come on, you know, she's very excited. All right, Raj, well, thank you so much. A great honor, a Reborn in the USA, a number one New York Times bestseller. Of course, Men in Blazers and all the other fantastic things that you accomplish every single solitary day. Roger, thank you so much for being with us today.
Thank you for having me, Joe. Really, really love it. To you, to health, to happiness, to your listeners, courage.
Courage.
Thanks, guys.
Thanks. Hey, thanks so much for listening to the Joe Scarborough Podcast. How fun was that? I just absolutely love Roger Bennett. Hope we can get him back here sometime soon and look forward to talking to you soon again on the Joe Scarborough Podcast. Have a great day.